The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes. Our subject today is a new article in the Stanford Law Review by NYU law professor Sam Raskoff entitled Establishing Official Islam, The Law and Strategy of Counter-Radicalization. Sam visited the Brookings Institution today to discuss the new article. What is official Islam?
Well, here's how I think about it. In the name of doing what the government sometimes calls countering violent extremism, but is more frequently known as counter-radicalization, officials from Washington down to the state and local level have inevitably gotten into the business of saying what Islam is and, frankly, putting a thumb on the scale in the favor of what they regard as mainstream Islam, as opposed to some of its more radical variants that they regard as being implicated in potential terrorist violence. So the government, really from top to bottom, in the name of performing a national security function, is getting into the business, I think, of managing the boundaries of permissible Islam within the United States.
So let's talk about some examples of that. You say from the federal government on down, Describe, you know, several examples at different levels of government, of the government managing the boundaries of permissible Islam.
Yeah, well, it's really happening all over the place. So take, for example, John Brennan, the president's top advisor on counterterrorism. Brennan has given a number of speeches across the country in which he's offered an account of what jihad means. And in particular, Brennan has taken exception to the view that's out there, namely that jihad has some kind of violent connotation. To Brennan, it means a purely spiritual activity, and Brennan has said as much. Now, that may not be as striking to some, but imagine that the president's top advisors were offering views about core tenets of Catholic or Jewish theology, and I think you have a beginning of a sense of what's in my view, striking about that. But it's not just senior officials, and it's not just speechifying. In the state of Ohio, the community engagement officer within their Homeland Security department at the state level has been involved in producing literature directed at youth that touts the virtues of mainstream Islam and its universal appeal. That's a direct quote from his own statements. And at the same time, that same department within Ohio has been involved in the in convening a council of imams to advise on aspects of counter-radicalization. The FBI and local law enforcement perennially get into the business of doing outreach to Muslim communities, and in doing so, they're inevitably making choices about who's in and who's out. And in my view, those decisions are going to be implicated in the construction of what I call official Islam as well. It goes on in prisons, it goes on in prison libraries, it goes on in the selection of chaplains within the military. In short, I think aspects of this official Islam phenomenon are pervasive.
And are they inevitable? I mean, in a situation in which, from the Bureau's point of view, you do have to manage relations with a community, you do have to put some people in that community under very serious surveillance, and you have to have a relationship with the rest of the community such that they'll cooperate with investigations. From the point of view of the military, you got to figure out who in Iraq you're going to engage with, right, and who you're not. Isn't there an elemental theological element to that project of figuring out how to manage those relations, or is there something, or is it not inevitable?
Well, I think on some level it is inevitable. After all, our counterterrorism is bound up with an account of radical Islam that's offered by al-Qaeda and its ideological sympathizers. That account, we can talk about this some more later, but that account in some way implicates this great religious tradition. And so inevitably, in prosecuting what I'll loosely call the war on terror, American officials are going to get into the business of making what amount to theological determinations. But I think what's striking in the paper that I've now published and in the research that I did leading up to it is the degree to which this is going on at an explicit level. In other words, officials more and more are seeing themselves as participating in decisions that essentially go to whether a certain view is within or outside the boundaries of mainstream Islam. Maybe the best example in that respect would be Bureau of Prisons, where historically, and I think for perfectly good reasons, prison officials have been concerned with the selection of chaplains on the basis of worries about security within the prison, fair enough. But under the counter-radicalization imperative, prison officials are now concerned not just with security within the confines of the prison, but with national security. And so their selection of chaplains goes to ideological criteria that they think have to do with protecting the homeland, not just with protecting the prison population.
And do you think this is qualitatively different from the government's engagement with other ideological religious movements that we have confronted in the past? I mean, you discussed toward the end of your paper sort of anti-communism as a quasi-model here. But this does seem different from that. And I'm curious whether you have any, whether there's any analog in your mind to what's going on in the official Islam phenomenon in prior ideological struggles that the government has engaged.
Well, probably the closest analog in strictly religious terms would be the government's fairly heavy-handed dealing with Mormons, and specifically with the issue of Mormon polygamy in the last century and even earlier in the late 19th century. I hardly think of that as a model for how the government ought to be comporting itself with respect to Islam nowadays. But picking up on your Cold War question and on the implication that what we're doing now in some ways mimics anti-communist efforts during the Cold War and perhaps even earlier, I think that is true on some level. There is an affinity there because, after all, counter-radicalization, like anti-communism, is in a sense the soft side of the war that's kind of dominating the headlines today, similar to the anti-communism in respect to the Cold War. But frankly, what's different are two things. First of all, the First Amendment's special concern for religious liberty, and we could talk about that some more, but my paper has a lot to say about the ways in which counter-radicalization implicates the Establishment Clause and the free exercise guarantee of the First Amendment. And it's not just about the law and about the Constitution and the First Amendment, but there is a sense in which the American government is, I think, uniquely handicapped as a strategic matter when it deals with the religious aspects of ideology. So both on the law and on strategy, even though there is a kind of very loose affinity between what we're doing now and what was done in the name of anti-communism, I think nowadays we're actually handicapped in two very significant regards.
So let's talk about the First Amendment. The body of your paper is all leads to an Establishment Clause anxiety, which you caveat by saying that you're really not sure whether this would result in judicial opinions sort of striking down official Islam or kind of executive branch guidance that what would be inappropriate to do. But there is this anxiety that the intervention in the substantive meaning of a religious movement is really not what the government should be doing. And yet, you also say that to some degree this is inevitable. And so I guess my question is, how much of it, what's the boundaries between the part that's inevitable and therefore presumably okay, and the part that is not inevitable and that crosses this line into, you know, an impermissible or certainly inadvisable or constitutionally troubling intervention in the substantive affairs of a religion?
Well, when I say it's inevitable, I think what I meant to be saying is that it's inevitable to the extent that the government goes down this path of trying to sort out the ideological foundations of terrorism and meaningfully to intervene into that ideological space. Now, I should say at the outset, I'm skeptical about our government's capacity to do that and meaningfully to actually alter the discourse within Islam. I'm skeptical roughly for two reasons. One, I don't think that there is the competence that resides within the government, the federal government or state and local counterparts, to be able to actually develop the sort of nuanced account of Islamic theology that would be required in order successfully to make these kinds of interventions. But even if it were, I'd be skeptical because the government, by dint of the fact that it is the United States government or it's the state of Ohio or it's the New York City Police Department, appears on the scene with a very specific aura, and not the aura of the independent theologian coming from within a specific tradition, but rather with the aura of the all-powerful state, and specifically the national security state, with an agenda, and that's an agenda to prevent subways and buildings from exploding, a natural and well-warranted agenda, but all the same, not one that's calculated to make Muslims inside the United States or anywhere feel as though these spokesmen on behalf of official Islam have the best for Islam or a kind of integrity within Islam and the warrant to be able to speak to these issues. So I'm skeptical about the project for very basic strategic reasons. I'm also skeptical for kind of loosely defined kind of First Amendment Establishment Clause type reasons. And what I'd like to say about that is that a lot of our Establishment Clause thinking for a generation has been preoccupied with concerns about religious encroachments onto the state or into the state. Think about prayer in school or even the vouchers issue. Think about perennial questions about symbolic religious displays on public land. But counter-radicalization essentially reverses that trajectory and actually, in a sense, restores one of the core concerns that the framers of the First Amendment had with respect to the establishment of religion, namely secular incursions into a religious tradition or a religious phenomenon. And so what's going on here is that the state is essentially arrogating to itself the right to be, in effect, a decisor of Islamic law or a shaper of meaning within Islamic tradition. And that's something that, under the banner of anti-Erastianism, Madison and Jefferson were well aware of and, frankly, very concerned about.
Now, what is anti-Erastianism?
Well, yeah, the basic idea behind anti-Erastianism is that the government will, at times, tend to try to shape religion in order to essentially aggrandize itself, for the state to aggrandize itself at the expense of religion. The term actually comes from a 16th century Swiss German theologian named Thomas Erastus. But what it came to mean by the time the First Amendment was in play was this basic notion that the state, in competition with religion, would try to use religion in order to serve a larger secular or kind of political objective. And so I think that's exactly what's going on here. Oftentimes when I present the kind of the core of this argument to friends or to colleagues, what I get back is, but surely the state, the secular state, motivated after all by the perfectly secular and attractive desire to protect its citizens, surely the state should be allowed to manipulate religion here and there in order to achieve that secular objective, to which I think the perfectly correct and in a sense complete response is, no, that's precisely the kind of Erastian impulse that the framers of the First Amendment had in mind when they put in the Establishment Clause into the Constitution.
But surely they were not thinking of religious movements when they sought to protect religion from, you know, encroachments by the state and definition and co-optation from the state. They weren't thinking about protecting insane and violent elements of religious movements against their more moderate brethren, right? I mean, there is something a little bit perverse about applying the anti-Erastianist instinct to very violent movements that, you know, articulate a vision and act on a vision that involves mayhem and death, right?
Well, I think mayhem and death probably, there's probably a mayhem and death exception to the Establishment Clause of a certain kind. But here's what I think is actually going on in the name of counter-radicalization, which is a lot more subtle and I think a lot more potentially pernicious than that. It's not that the state is saying, to the extent that there's a one-to-one correlation between certain ideas and the carrying out of suicide attacks, that those ideas are nevertheless entitled to the same amount of protection as any other kind of religious idea. What they're saying is we need to fan out a great deal more broadly than the thinking that actually correlates in some kind of one-to-one way with the commission of violence. And we need to consider the pool of all potential candidates for terrorist violence, and to do so, we have to think about the enterprise of what the state will call radical Islam in its totality. So it's no longer thinking about people who are minded to blow things up or en route to blowing things up. It's talking about people who subscribe to a religious outlook that is implicated in some loose, powerful, but still kind of inchoate way with the commission of violence, and that the state is going to target the enterprise of that ideology writ large. And that's what I think is going on here. Now, the connection between radical religious ideation and violence is a complicated one, not just within Islam, but frankly, within all religious traditions, and I don't purport to be an expert on that intersection. But I will say that, you know, push hard enough on any given religious tradition, and you'll find that there are going to be some violent manifestations of that religion, and then allow for the fact that all potentially doctrinaire, orthodox, radical practitioners of that religion are deemed to be candidates for that kind of violence down the road, and I think we're looking at the kind of problem that I'm talking about.
So in your account, a lot of this material has its origins in Britain. And you give a, you almost describe the sort of counter-radicalization programmatic instinct as sort of a British import. So talk a little about the British experience. Have they, has the British experience, does it give rise to the anxieties that you've described? Does it have much to show for itself in terms of success? And does it, implicate the government in Erastianist impulses that we should be against?
I think the answer to that is all of the above. In some very deep way, American domestic counter-radicalization is, just as you implied, a British import. And in particular, American officials are essentially trying to bring into the American repertoire a program that's highly contentious and highly politically divisive in the UK, namely one called Prevent, which is part of their overall counterterrorism strategy in the United Kingdom. There's an irony in that the United States is more drawn to Prevent nowadays than the Brits seem to be. They seem to have fairly lost confidence in the program, and I'll explain why in a second. But here we are, even as the program has essentially been sapped of its political capital and its social support in the United Kingdom, the import is nevertheless taking root in some way in the United States nowadays. Now, what did Prevent stand for? It essentially amounted to a sweeping domestic counter-radicalization program. As it was initially conceived, it was actually a very bold one and a program that was led by police and by security officials in concert with certain grassroots organizations. But the impulse behind Prevent was to say the government needed to partner up with voices within the Muslim communities of the United Kingdom that, while in a sense radical, were nevertheless committed to nonviolence, and to make those radical but nonviolent voices the principal allies for the government in its counter-radicalization, for the reason that the government regarded those authentically radical voices, let's call them, but committedly nonviolent ones, as their best allies, their best hopes for actually winning over the kind of young men who are in danger of transitioning from radical ideation to actually wanting to blow up the London Tube. Now, the security officials in the United Kingdom who essentially debuted this program came under enormous political pressure, and they've essentially lost, under the Cameron government, the larger ideological fight. I think of the early Prevent folks as essentially being proponents of a Big Ten strategy. That is, they regarded it as necessary and desirable to have radical members of the Muslim community, who again were radical even as they were committed to nonviolence. They regarded those as being essential ingredients to a successful counter-radicalization program. And essentially what Prime Minister Cameron has said is the government will not do business with members of society who have values that fall outside of the British mainstream. And so if these radical but nonviolent voices are simultaneously deeply homophobic or deeply anti-Semitic or deeply anti-Shiite or deeply anti-feminist, the Cameron government has basically said it won't do business with them, which in effect has been the demise of the Prevent program, or at least the demise of the Prevent strategy as it was initially conceptualized.
And in the United States, what is the influence of Prevent? I mean, you say there's a residue of Prevent that's gone from Britain but lives on in the United States. What is that core?
Well, that core is essentially the sum total of everything that we're doing, at least at the national level, in the name of what the Obama administration calls countering violent extremism. And the impulse to want to import Prevent, it should be said, derives from a kind of strategic observation, which may or may not hold true, depending on who you ask, but was regarded and is still regarded by some as being true, namely that the United States is experiencing some amount of threat from so-called homegrown terrorists on par with the threat that the United Kingdom has been confronting from its own homegrown population roughly since 2005 and the 7/7 bombings there. So it was that kind of strategic insight, or bit of, if you want to think of it this way, as kind of strategic intelligence, that drove the American national security apparatus to start thinking, well, if we have a British-style problem on our hands, and by the way, I don't mean to be suggesting that we do, but I'm just suggesting this is part of the syllogism that national security officials have essentially taken on board. If we have a problem that in some way resembles the British, then we ought to think about a British-style solution. And everything that I've said in describing the reach of American counter-radicalization is in some sense a derivative of the British, with one, it should be said, very important difference, which is that whereas the strategic issues that I talk about in this paper and that we're talking about are alive and well in the United Kingdom, surely the constitutional traditions about establishment are not just different, but I would say 180 degrees different in the United Kingdom, what with the fact that they have an established church.
Yeah, and the Queen is the head of it.
The Queen is the head of it. So, and it's in fact a precise instance of the kind of establishment that Madison was resisting.
So I am interested in the question to the extent that this raises real constitutional issues, and that there is some line wherever it is that a counter-radicalization program cannot cross without really coming up against the Establishment Clause. What is the mechanism by which we find out where that line is? It's hard to imagine the person with standing to bring an Establishment Clause challenge to a counter-radicalization program. It's hard to imagine some of these issues, you know, whether the Ohio Homeland Security Department can have a position about what jihad means or doesn't mean. It's hard to imagine the justiciability mechanism for that. You allude to this issue but you don't really discuss it. And I'm curious what your thoughts about the mechanism of Establishment Clause consideration of these issues, what it is likely to be and what in your view it should be.
Well, I quite agree that it's unlikely to be some kind of pronouncement by a federal court to the effect this or that program is flat out unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause.
Can I just ask you something about that?
Yeah.
You know, you cite, that seems to me a little bit perverse in some sense, because as you point out, we have these Establishment Clause issues over these transcendently unimportant questions like that implicate things like interior decor of, you know, public buildings, implicate the question of what speeches who can and can't give at graduations, etc. But what you're describing is actually a substantial government intervention in the internal affairs of the meaning of a religion, roughly the same as if the government had tried to sponsor the Second Vatican Council. And we're starting this part of the conversation with an agreement that it's most unlikely to trigger a judicial... I mean, isn't that a little perverse?
Well, I think it's actually a lot perverse, because just as your question implied, what we're talking about here, what's at stake in this kind of Establishment Clause issue, in my view, is something like the essence of the Establishment Clause. And that's a far cry from a lot of what gets litigated under the banner of the First Amendment's religion clauses. I think there's reason to be a little bit confident or a little bit upbeat about the prospect of some kind of judicial intervention here. And that flows from the Supreme Court's recent, namely last month's opinion in Hosanna Tabor, where by a 9-0 vote, the Supreme Court essentially rejected the Obama administration's perspective on whether the court or whether a religious community had the final say on which individuals counted as ministers within a religious tradition. And for reasons that essentially coalesce with the kind of anti-Erastian arguments that I debut in this paper, the court said, in effect, again, unanimously, that a religious tradition ought to be free from government interference in making decisions about who counts as a minister for purposes of that religious tradition. And so there is a sense in which the anti-Erastian core of the Establishment Clause may be back in vogue. At the same time, there is an opposite trend going on, which would tend to make me a little bit more pessimistic than I even might have been 2 years ago about the prospects of a court getting involved here, namely the issue of taxpayer standing. And here we're kind of getting out into a fairly recherché issue of law. But let me just say very succinctly, for a generation or so, it was the understanding that standing in Establishment Clause cases was relaxed to the extent that taxpayers could sue in federal court claiming that their money was being used by the government in order to support some kind of unconstitutional establishment, and that was sufficient grounds for standing in this one context. The Supreme Court last year essentially reversed course and substantially called into question the taxpayer standing doctrine in Establishment Clause cases. So I'm no longer as sanguine as I might have been on the standing issue.
So what's the mechanism?
So then the mechanisms are really twofold. On a kind of very technical inside baseball level, the mechanism might well be a conscientious executive branch lawyer writing a memo in the office of legal counsel or a legal opinion for that has a kind of binding effect within the executive branch. These issues have occasionally surfaced within the OLC. I don't know that there's ever been a kind of resolution on the part of executive branch lawyers of these issues one way or the other. Sometime in the second Bush administration, that is in the second 4 years of President George W. Bush's administration, the OLC was called on to answer a question having to do with whether American reconstruction money in Iraq could be devoted to the rebuilding of a mosque that was destroyed as part of the hostilities there. Raising arguably some kind of Establishment Clause issue. And to the best of my knowledge, the OLC never got around to resolving that issue. But the OLC could, in some level, supply some kind of mechanism of the sort that you're asking about. I'm actually more confident in the, call it, larger conversation that might be stimulated from discussions like the one we're having now, and a kind of consciousness-raising campaign to put this issue of religious liberty on the agenda in connection with counterterrorism.
So I'm interested about your own experience. You ran the intelligence group for the NYPD, which had some of these community outreach concerns, obviously. And I'm interested from the point of view of local law enforcement. What's the right way for them to think about engaging and engagement and the communities with it, you know, with which they have to engage, have ongoing liaison relationships? If they're really not allowed to talk to them about the substance of their religious views, or that when they do talk to them about the substance of their religious views, they're really only allowed to listen, not to speak. What's the right way for them to think about, as somebody who's had to do that, what's the right way for them to think about that project?
Well, I think the right way for local officials, really for any officials, to conceptualize this whole domain of counter-radicalization is a way in which it's worth mentioning the Obama administration has recently begun to talk about this issue kind of more explicitly, and in my view, appropriately, and I kind of salute this approach to countering violent extremism, namely a sense that the grassroots communities themselves hold the keys to whatever kind of solution there's going to be in the ideological aspects of counterterrorism. And so the government should essentially operate with the lightest possible touch. It should be concerned about these sorts of developments, but when it comes to solutions, it ought to be essentially causing local actors, private actors in the sense of non-governmental actors, to be doing the heavy lifting in order both to succeed strategically and also to avoid whatever kinds of legal issues may or may not be floating on the margins of these programs.
One last question. How did you get interested in this?
Well, I mean, that's partly to do with my own personal experience at the NYPD, but I think it also comes from a sense that having spoken Arabic for much of my adult life and having been immersed in the religious life of Muslims through my study of classical Islam over the years, I had a sense that a lot of what was being said about Islam in the national security space was incredibly shallow at times, and at other times outright dangerous and harmful. And whereas the government's involvement in what I'm calling official Islam is a far cry from the kind of hateful Islamophobic rhetoric that we sometimes read about, unfortunately, it nevertheless struck me that this whole project of the government getting into the business of managing Islam reflected a deep, almost conceptual error on the part of American officials. The idea that they were going to be able to have bureaucrats sitting in Washington or state capitals or police precincts get to the bottom of one of the great religious traditions and to affect meaningful change within that kind of religious tradition, that struck me in a sense as being deeply incompatible with my own fingertip feel for Islam and, frankly, for the structure of any great religious tradition.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Ben. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Lawfare Podcast, a project of the Harvard Law School Brookings Project on Law and Security. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.